right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Iran nuclear talks approach fourth deadline. Greece fears bailout deal could threaten tourism.
Tourism is more important in terms of GDP than industry and agriculture put together.
Worries grow in the U.S. over computer encryption. One of Broadway's greatest musicals takes on a new look. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Back-to-back meetings between nuclear negotiators in Vienna have pushed Iran talks to the final day after three deadline extensions in as many weeks. With no announcements made, U.S. and European diplomats worked through dinner late Sunday in an effort to resolve what a senior U.S. State Department official warned earlier in the day were major issues to be resolved in the talks. For more than 2 weeks, international journalists have been camped outside the Iran nuclear talks in Austria's capital, awaiting word of a possible deal between Tehran and six world powers. Heather Murdoch is one of those journalists monitoring the discussions. She spoke with International Edition's Michael Lippin about what major obstacles still remain to an agreement.
They don't tell us exactly what the major issues are, but there's been a couple of sticking points from the beginning with these negotiations. So we presume that the issues involve the possible inspections of Iran's military sites, and also the timing of sanctions relief. Another issue that's come up recently, though, is the arms embargo, where Iran has asked for a lift of the arms embargo, and the Western countries are very much against this.
Why are those Western countries opposed to lifting that arms embargo?
Because one of the major reasons they're having these talks in the first place is a fear of a conflict between Iran and the United States. So they don't want to have more weapons flowing into Iran, or Iran selling more weapons, especially because they suspect Iran of supporting militant groups all over the Middle East, some of which Iran says they support, like Hezbollah. Others they don't admit openly, like the Houthis in Yemen, and other various groups in Syria.
And why do the Iranians make such a big deal out of getting the arms embargo lifted?
Well, I think that it's just for Iran, you know, as a sovereign country, it doesn't want other countries to be telling it what it can buy and what it can sell, and they stand to make, you know, quite a bit of money in arms sales.
What do observers of the talks there in Vienna think about all of these deadlines for the negotiations that keep coming and going? Are they getting more cynical, or do they think that the next deadline will be the last?
Well, a lot of the observers, by the way, here at the talks are here not just observing, but in support of the talks. So a lot of them will play down the missing of the deadlines and saying, forget the deadlines, let's just get it done. It does worry some people that it's continuing to go on, but there's a lot of hope that this deadline is the final one.
So how challenging is it to cover a process like this with so much uncertainty about the time frame for the talks and, you know, who's involved in these negotiations at any one time, given the fact that you have people coming and going constantly?
It is kind of a frustrating story to report. You know, you have to change your plans all the time, and then there's a lot of hurry up and wait because there's very little information. So, you know, you have to create tons of reports on without new information. And so a lot of speculation goes into the story. So that's difficult. Last time when we were reporting it in Switzerland, it was very similar, although there was more information coming from diplomats then than now. And it was frustrating, and the journalists were exhausted and tired and sick of the missing the deadlines by the time they finally came up with something. But what they did come up with was so interesting and so huge, you know, that it was kind of worth it in the end as a journalist to cover it.
VOA's Heather Murdoch in Vienna speaking with International Edition's Michael Lippin. Time now to check out what's trending on the web. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio to do just that. Hello, G, and what's happening?
Hi, Ray. Like Heather just mentioned, it looks like negotiators from Iran and six world powers could be wrapping up this round of talks very soon. Media reports say several diplomats involved in the talks have hinted they will announce a decision as early as today. Here's what an official with the Iranian Foreign Ministry tweeted earlier Sunday. "We're working hard, but a deal tonight is simply logistically impossible. This is a 100-page document after all." The Iranian Foreign Ministry's counselors on Twitter, at Mir Youssefi, that's M-I-R-Y-O-U-S-E-F-I. I also wanted to mention that VOA's Victoria Maki did a story on the negotiators possibly pushing the announcement of the final deal to today. A reader from Houston, Texas named Lawrence Bush wrote in the comments section, "Delays are acceptable, but not any loopholes in the final nuclear settlement with Iran." That reader added, "A nuclear agreement doesn't signify Washington normalizing ties with Tehran."
All right, but what about the top nuclear negotiators from the United States and Iran? Have they been tweeting at all?
Yes, the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry wrote he met with Federica Mogherini, who is the vice president of the EU, as well as the Iranian foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. Kerry added they still have difficult issues to resolve. His Iranian counterpart Zarif hasn't been tweeting since Thursday. Mogherini, who is also the high representative of EU for foreign affairs and security policy, tweeted, "All EU team at work on hashtag Iran talks decisive hours."
And what about the attention all the talk is getting on social media?
Well, during the past day, hashtag Iran talks Vienna was used more than 12,000 times. And the social media analytics website Topsy also showed that hashtag Iran talks was used just as much. That's all for me today.
Thanks for bringing us that update. Social media correspondent G. Abby Lee. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's spelled J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Skeptical European leaders struggled Sunday to reach an accord with debt-racked Greece over its latest austerity plan, voicing doubts that Athens would live up to its promises to cut spending and increase taxes. The heads of the 19 nations in Europe's euro currency bloc are considering a pledge by Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras to impose another $12 billion in new taxes and spending cuts in exchange for approving Greece's third bailout in 5 years, a three-year $60 billion loan. Despite fears of economic catastrophe if there is no bailout agreement with international lenders, tourists are still flocking to Greece. Bookings this year are holding up well, for now. Henry Ridgewell has more from Athens.
To the sounds of buskers playing Greek folk music, thousands of tourists wander among the ruins of the Acropolis that looms over Athens, walking in the foundations of Western civilization. Meanwhile, a short boat ride away lie hundreds of idyllic islands bathed in the Mediterranean sun. Then there's the rich and bountiful cuisine. It's easy to see why Greece tops many vacationers' wish lists. Last year, tourism receipts hit a record $15.1 billion. Alexander Lamnidis is general manager of the Greek Tourism Federation.
Tourism is more important in terms of GDP than industry and agriculture put together.
Visitors at the famous Acropolis in Athens said they had experienced no problems.
Many people discouraged us from coming. We saw the news back in the U.S. And honestly, it seemed a little overblown. We made phone calls here to some of the hotels we were staying at, and they said, things are calm, please come.
We are from Germany, and it's no problem for us. We had no fears to come to Greece.
Despite the crisis, millions of tourists are visiting Greece at this time. Tourism officials say it is vital to support this industry if Greece's economy is to recover. Among the tax increases proposed by lenders, however, is a rise in VAT to 23%. Greek islands would also lose their existing VAT discount. Again, Alexander Lamnidis.
When the VAT in France is 10%, and it is between 8 and 10% in most of the South European countries, including Turkey, that is 8%, of course, is a non-EU member. Therefore, all we say is that we have to be competitive. So 23% is huge.
Konstantin Mikolos, president of the Athens Chamber of Commerce, says some of Europe's demands would hamper economic growth.
Our heavy industry in this country is tourism. So what we need to do on both sides is to understand which are the structural reforms which are positive for the economy, sustainable by the Greek people, so that our partners can hope that at the end of the day, the dues from Greece will be paid in full.
Apart from delays at some ATMs, officials say Greece is as peaceful as ever. Locals say the best way to aid economic recovery is simple. Visit Greece, enjoy all it has to offer, and spend plenty of euros. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Athens.
For over a year now, the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, James Comey, has been on a campaign warning against the dangers of computer encryption. He is pushing congressional leaders and Silicon Valley executives to build in such secret safeguards as what are called backdoors and key escrows that would give agencies like the FBI emergency access to data critical for stopping crime and protecting national security. But now a group of cybersecurity researchers and cryptographers is pushing back against the FBI director, arguing that such measures could make the entire Internet significantly more vulnerable to hacking attacks. International Edition's Doug Bernard follows cyber issues and spoke with VOA's Pete Heinlein about the encryption debate.
Think of encryption as sort of like a lock. Encryption allows you to take your data, your photos, your emails, all your electronic communication, and kind of lock it up such that anybody who doesn't have that lock won't be able to get access to it. It'll just be electronic gibberish. So it's a great way to protect your information from prying eyes. Now, one of the reasons, the principal reasons, I think Director Comey is so concerned about encryption is because he says, look, as so much of our lives are kept on mobile devices now, that data very often can be useful in helping stop crime or even, you know, protect the national security. But with encryption, without those keys to get inside it, the mobile phones and computers, as he calls, as he says it, become safes that you can never unlock.
Well, okay, key escrows? Escrow is something I associate with real estate.
Right.
And what's a back door? Or, you know, I don't even know about the front door.
Exactly. So if we're thinking of encryption as something like a lock, think about your data as being kept in perhaps a house. Your house has front door, back door, maybe windows, whatnot. These are all ways that bad guys potentially can break into your house and steal your stuff. So in an electronic form, these are basically pathways that bad guys can use to get in and steal your data and, you know, muck about with your things. So much as your front door is the main point of access, a back door is actually a secret path that a software engineer builds into a program, and perhaps only they and perhaps maybe the government only knows ideally about that back door. A key escrow, think of it as like giving a key to a neighbor. That neighbor becomes, they end up holding a bunch of keys to all their neighbor's house so that if something happens and somebody needs to get in, they're a trusted person, they can take that key that you've given them and get into it.
Okay, so we hear what Director Comey is saying. Well, sounds like common sense. Well, what are the cryptographers saying? Why don't they agree?
Well, you know, when you think about, you know, protecting your house and locks and doors and that sort of thing, it does really kind of make good sense. But what cryptographers are saying is, look, you know, encryption and cryptography are really much more complicated than these metaphors and analogies that we use. So what they're saying is that any point of access into a system creates a vulnerability. So the least vulnerable house in the world is one that has no doors, no windows, and no way to get in or out. But that's not very useful. So they like to keep entry points as few as possible by building in back doors, perhaps, or key escrows where the encryption keys are held. What they're saying is fundamentally you are building insecurity not only into that encrypted system, but really into the internet as a whole. And so if you push for these things, you're just going to make the internet less secure, increase the number of hacking attacks, and put more of your private data at risk.
Okay. Well, I'm just one little guy. I can see if they want to hack the government or the CIA. But, hey, why should I care?
Well, you know, it's one thing to think, you know, I don't really have anything to hide. You hear that a lot. You know, I'm just me. You know, I don't really worry about it. I think almost universally is that people may say that up until the point that their data is hacked. People may say, I feel secure in my house. I don't really worry about crime, up until the point that somebody breaks in and steals things. And then so often you hear those individuals saying, I feel fundamentally violated. I don't feel safe anymore. And I think the same is true electronically. If you may feel safe and comfortable online, but up until that moment that someone steals your identity or steals your data or starts putting out false things about you on the internet, then you start feeling very vulnerable and you really understand the value, I think, of encryption.
International Edition's Doug Bernard speaking with VOA's Pete Heinlein. In the coming weeks, three more Republicans are set to join the already large field of presidential contenders for the 2016 election. VOA's Jim Malone reports on the accelerating race for the White House.
The battle for 2016 is underway. Jeb Bush, Democrat Hillary Clinton, and Rick Perry greeted New Hampshire voters as Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker prepares to join the Republican field on Monday.
Voters really do want leaders who stand up and make the tough decisions.
Ohio Governor John Kasich will join the race a week later, followed by former Virginia Governor Jim Gilmore, creating a field of 17 contenders with no clear frontrunner, says Republican analyst Scott Faulkner.
No matter how much people look at running for during the next year plus as performance art, at some point someone's going to say, well, what have you actually done? And Walker and Kasich have a record that they can be proud of.
Businessman Donald Trump continues to surge in the polls, even as Republican leaders tell him to tone down his comments on illegal immigrants.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
It's true. We're all here together.
Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton remains the favorite in the Democratic race, but Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is drawing huge crowds.
This great country and our government belong to all of the people and not just a handful of very wealthy people.
Polls show Sanders has pulled closer to Clinton in the early contest states of Iowa and New Hampshire. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Still to come, a Broadway musical classic gets a makeover. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. An extra year of schooling could cut the risk of HIV infection by a third. The authors of a new study say education is cost-effective as HIV prevention alone, not counting all the other benefits. VOA's Steve Barragona explains.
Despite unprecedented global public health efforts, more than 2 million people are infected with HIV each year, notes Boston University health economist Jacob Bohr.
There's a real question about how to reduce that number and how to get to a place where the epidemic is really on the decline.
That question is especially pressing in Botswana, where nearly a quarter of the population is infected. Many experts believe more educated people are less likely to contract the virus, but it's been hard to prove. In 1996, Botswana made a change in its education system that offered a natural experiment. The government moved grade 10 back to junior secondary school, which previously had ended at grade 9. The researchers wanted to see what impact that extra year of schooling had years later when the students were adults.
The effects are large, and we were surprised by how large they were.
Writing in the journal The Lancet Global Health, the study found the risk of infection fell about 8 percentage points. From 25% to 17%. The effects were even larger for women, nearly 12 percentage points. And it was cost-effective, in roughly the same range as other proven prevention strategies.
I think that this study really provides evidence that we should consider formal schooling, particularly secondary schooling, as part of HIV prevention.
In an accompanying commentary, New York University health economist Karen Greppen said the study provides strong and compelling evidence that education can lower HIV risk. But she added, there's more to gain.
The other reason to keep people in education is actually to educate them and provide them with better opportunities later in life as well.
It's not clear exactly how education lowers HIV risk. Better job prospects might be a factor, especially for women. Or the additional schooling may be improving cognitive skills that help people make better decisions. Bohr says upcoming research will address those questions. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
The musicals of Rodgers and Hammerstein have been staples of the American theater since they were created in the 1940s and 50s. In just the last few years, South Pacific and The King and I have seen Tony-winning revivals. Now, a highly experimental version of their first musical, Oklahoma, is being staged at the Bard Summerscape Festival in upstate New York. Jeff London has details.
Oklahoma was different from the beginning. When it opened on Broadway in 1943, it was considered pretty radical, says Ted Chapin, who represents the Rodgers and Hammerstein estates.
Even though today we take it for granted that all the pieces of a musical work with each other, it was a bit of a revelation then. The fact that every song had to do with character, that dance came out of the song after you couldn't sing it anymore, you had to dance it. All of those things, which today we almost take for granted, but before Oklahoma, it was sort of unheard of.
Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain.
On the surface, Oklahoma seems like a simple story about a young woman deciding whether to go to a party with a nice young cowboy or a dangerous, lonely farmhand. But there's a dark undercurrent to the story. The show is set at the turn of the 20th century, before Oklahoma became a state, when the territory was in social and political upheaval. Producer Gideon Lester says Rodgers and Hammerstein understood this.
There is no history of colonization or expansion or the building of nationhood that doesn't contain violence in it. And Oklahoma dramatizes that. Now, it does it in a way that is sunny and funny and full of beautiful music. And that juxtaposition makes that violence even more disquieting, I think.
And I sit by myself like a cobweb on a shelf by myself in a lonely room.
And disquiet is just what director Daniel Fish is after. To help the audience feel the musical's conflicting emotions, he puts them close to the action. They sit at long tables on all four sides of the playing space, which is made to look like a community hall. There's no chorus or orchestra, just a six-piece band on stage. And the actors sometimes just speak their lines, sitting in chairs.
Lots of things happen to folks. Sickness, or being poor and hungry even. Being old and afeared to die. That's the way it is. Cradle to grave.
And the staging of a crucial scene in which Curly, the cowboy, confronts Judd, the farmhand, is especially unsettling. Fish says Hammerstein described Judd's gloomy hovel in detail.
That it's dark, that it's the source of a kind of sexuality and a kind of unknown. And so, how do you do that in this space? Well, sometimes the dumb answer is the best answer. Well, what happened if we do the scene in the dark?
A fellow wouldn't feel very safe in here with you if he didn't know you. But I know you, Judd. In this country, there's two things you can do if you're a man. Live out of doors is one, and live in a hole is the other.
Damon Dono plays Curly and says the staging has an impact.
And it's amazing how uncomfortable a bit of darkness makes people, understandably, but it really changes the sort of spine in the room. You can really feel that.
Where the production may be most controversial is at its end. The original play's accidental death becomes a cold-blooded murder. Daniel Fish says this makes a deliberate point.
It makes the community culpable. And I would argue that it probably makes the audience culpable as well.
And that, he says, gives them something to think about.
You know, it's an old story, but it's also a story that matters now in terms of issues of community, in terms of violence, in terms of how we create outsiders, and in terms of love.
Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful...
For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. For more news and information, go to our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Brazil have a long history of strong bilateral relations. The two countries hold similar views and goals on many issues. So, for example, both countries are committed to expanding inclusive economic growth and prosperity, promoting international peace and security and respect for human rights, and helping people in need, not just in the United States and Brazil, but globally. This is particularly true of countries that face chronic hunger, such as Mozambique. Mozambique needs help. 2 decades ago, the country emerged from 16 years of civil war that left it in shambles, and the 20 years of stability and peace since then have seen significant strides forward, including impressive economic growth. Nonetheless, Mozambique is prone to natural disasters such as droughts and floods, which damage the agricultural sector and the country's overall economy. That is one reason why much of the rural population is impoverished, and as much as 64% of Mozambicans are food insecure. Over the past 4 years, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the University of Florida and Michigan State University, and the Brazilian Cooperation Agency, or ABC, and other Brazilian government agencies have partnered with the government of Mozambique to work on reducing poverty, hunger, and malnutrition as part of Feed the Future, the U.S. government's Global Hunger and Food Security Initiative. The idea is to help strengthen the country's capacity to produce more high-quality and nutritious foods, like vegetables, oilseeds, and grain legumes. The partnership works with family and subsistence farmers to help them increase their yields and then enable them to bring their product to the market. The program strengthened the capacity of Mozambique's Agricultural Research Institute in research administration, seed production, and land use planning. It also worked to improve communication and extension information dissemination, including training and support to extension technicians. Experts from Brazil and the U.S. partners cooperated closely with Mozambican counterparts in making these gains. Farmers were also trained in new crop management practices, such as more environmentally sensitive irrigation technologies. They also learned how to plant better and more disease-resistant crop varieties and improve post-harvest handling in ways that reduced losses and increased incomes. On June 30th, during a meeting with Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, President Barack Obama announced an additional $2 million for expanding the USAID and ABC partnership to help Mozambique attain food security for all. No one should have to go to bed hungry. That is the goal to which all of us should aspire. The United States and Brazil are working to reach it, one country at a time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.